On this edition of Thinking Biblically, we learn about a secret biblical society. It's actually not that secret, you just may not know about it. Welcome to Thinking Biblically. My name is Alan Gilman. Thinking Biblically is a podcast dedicated to exploring how all of Scripture speaks to all of life. If you haven't done so already, please hit the subscribe button and the notification bell. And if you appreciate what you hear, please give it a thumbs up and be sure to share with others who you think will benefit. Today's interview is not new to Thinking Biblically, but I want to fill you in on something you may not be aware of. It's a scholarly society called the Society of Post-Supersessionist Theology. Post-supersessionism is another term for replacement theology, which is the dominant historic approach to the Scriptures, claiming the church has taken the place of the nation of Israel as God's covenant people. This is what's going on when you hear the church is the new Israel or the true Israel, but it's so pervasive and has so many modes of expression. I've dealt with the subject before and I'll continue to do so. I believe that this misguided ideology is ripping off Bible readers, and the fact that many would roll their eyes at such a comment shows how entrenched it is. Not only does replacement theology create a huge barrier between the church and the Jewish people, it prevents believers from getting the full nourishment available to us through the Bible. That's my justification for going after this issue on a podcast called Thinking Biblically. Anyway, it warms my heart to know that there's a group of scholars trying to get past the anti-Jewish blinders of supersessionism. I'll provide a link to their website at the close of this episode and include it in the description. So I'm sharing with you my recent conversation with Dr. Ralph Korner, professor at Taylor Seminary in Edmonton. We cover a lot of ground. I think you will see how burdened I am by this topic and how people approach it from many angles. I'd love to hear from you about what you think of our discussion. And if you have any questions or concerns, be it over this topic or anything else, yeah, please let me know. Anyway, I'll see you again when we close off. Well, it's my pleasure to introduce to you Ralph Korner. Dr. Ralph Korner, since 2014, has been professor of biblical studies at Taylor Seminary of Kairos University in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. From 1989 to 2000, he pastored two churches in Edmonton. He's also a certified journeyman electrician. Ralph received his PhD from McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, in ancient Judaism and early Christianity. He received his Master's of Arts in Biblical Studies from Trinity Western University in Langley, British Columbia. You see, we don't let him out of our country. And his BA in Religion from Taylor University College back in Edmonton, Alberta. Ralph has published two books, Origin and Meaning of Ecclesia in the Early Jesus Movement, and Reading Revelation After Supersessionism. He has a third book forthcoming. It's called Is Jesus the Only Way of Salvation? Yes, but that's not clickbait, is it?
The subtitle after that is, I forget what it is now. Reading John 14. So it's basically a reading of John 14. Yeah.
Okay, very good. Well, that's the, right. I'm the way, yeah. The truth, and the
just
life.
Quickly, I'm reading it through the lens of realized eschatology, not future eschatology. Big words. We can have a conversation about what that means later. Changes the emphasis.
Well, I think I know what they mean, but we'll see. If people watching or listening to this, you don't know what it means, you can send me an email or put it in the comments and we'll deal with it. But you really haven't lived until you've experienced realized eschatology.
John's eternal life, right? Okay. Life now, right. Not so just life future.
Yes, I think, folks, I have found another friend. So we'll see how this goes. But I do have, I should also say I wasn't done. Ralph is married to Kathy. They have four adult children and four grandchildren. And we did chat a little bit. It's the first time I'm meeting Ralph. And I do have an important question that a little bit off topic before we get into our main topic. And we did chat a little bit before. I was trying to do the math, but I wasn't sure if I was hitting it right. And the big question is, did you ever get to see Wayne Gretzky play in person?
No. in those days, I was in Calgary. So that would have been the last person in the world I would have wanted to see personally. I've been in Edmonton since 1989, and I still can't cheer for any Edmontonian teams. I'm still a Calgary at heart.
Yes, these things run deep. My wife and I are both from Montreal, and so of course, we're Montreal Canadiens fans, but we've lived across the country, and we lived many years in Vancouver, and I did get a chance to see Gretzky play for Edmonton live in Vancouver. And in those days, I wasn't, as a younger person, I followed sports big time. And I'm watching a little bit. I've been checking in quite a bit with the Blue Jays during this playoff run currently. But seeing Gretzky in person, that was a real treat in his heyday with Edmonton. It was always, really something whenever he touched the puck. Okay, so we'll move from this Canadian-centric thing to something a little more general for our audience here. So you're involved in something called the Society for Post-Supersessionist Theology. And before people turn us off, could you please explain what that is?
Oh, dear. Well, post-supersessionism, in its essence, is saying there is enduring value for Jewish identity and heritage, for followers of the Messiah, and that the identity, ethnic identity Israel and ethnic identity Judaios or Jew is not transferable to Gentiles. Thus, the church has not replaced Israel in terms of God's covenant people, or the church has not become the new or true Jew, but rather that Israel and Jew are reserved for genealogical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And that Jewishness continues to be a valid lifestyle for Jews who have come to faith in Christ. So that's sort of a big picture, you might say, which is lots of spin-offs, that we could talk a bit further about. So basically, supersessionism comes from the word supersede, meaning replace, and thus the idea that the church, followers of the Jewish Messiah, have replaced Israel in terms of God. Well, depends on your perspective, right? But their dispensationalism says it's replaced now at the tribulation, then God goes back to Israel and finishes and saves all Israel. So that's one way to track a supersessionist kind of a perspective.
So am I right when I equate supersessionism with replacement theology? Are they identical, or do people use them
differently? There's sort of this continuum from hard supersessionism and down to soft supersessionism. So there's a lot of variations within that perspective. So just because somebody's labeled, quote, supersessionist, doesn't mean that all of the possible ramifications of that understanding apply to every interpreter who might have, for example, N.T. Wright would not see himself as being supersessionist. He sees himself as having a middle road in the corporate Christology.
I wish we could bring him on right now and explain to him why actually. I love N.T. Wright. I think there's so much that he has added. We talked about realized eschatology at the beginning. I think he's so good with that, as well as Second Temple, the context of the Second Temple for the reading of the New Testament. But I think he really misses it on the Jewish.
I would concur on that as well. But he wouldn't be a hard supersessionist.
When you say hard, are you talking about the condemnation of the people of Israel for all time for the rejection of Jesus in the first century?
That would be hard? Very hard, yeah. So basically the hard would be God is done with the Jewish people outside of Christ, period.
Period.
That's the hard thing.
Right. And N.T. Wright does not believe that. He has a wonderful...
He just cares.
No. That, in terms of Jewish people. But the thing is, if you and we're kind of getting right into the meat of it, if you disenfranchise the Jewish people from their covenant to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and you just say, well, we should be nice to them and good to them like any other people, or just like anybody else, what have we done, scripturally speaking, as well as, it's like, So I in my conversations with people, there's a couple times I've connected, and you can tell me what you think. I've connected replacement theology, which is the more sounds like the more common term, not so fancy as supersessionism, but to anti-Semitism, and then they've reacted very negatively, and I've worked that through because I also, you know, most of my Christian best friends are supersessionists because it seems to be some sort of default setting. Hopefully we'll get into that as well. So a lot of people react because they're not anti-Semitic, but they do believe that the church is the new Israel and this sort of thing. And tell me what you think. I've created the illustration of, it's kind of like, people have moved into our house, but then they invite us over for tea every now and then. Like, oh, this is a nice place where you used to live. Too bad you can't. Well, you can't. If you go through a certain thing, maybe you can get back in, but this is our house now. It's not your house. And you could be nice about it, but actually, I think the biblical term for that is arrogance.
Great analogy. Yep.
You're nodding. Yeah. So back again. So just to clarify, don't worry about it if I've got this off. So when I explain supersessionism to people, I do equate it with replacement theology, and I think replacement theology people are also in that spectrum. But do I have that wrong?
Yeah, they'd be definitely in that spectrum. Yeah, replacement theology is definitely in that spectrum. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Okay. Before we move on to post-supersessionism, let's maybe just respond to that. Would you agree that supersessionism replacement theology is more or less a default setting in the Christian mind around the world? Or is that an overstatement?
I'd say that would be a default setting and probably a difficult one to get around. Particularly from a Jew who doesn't follow Jesus, for us, you know, for Christians to say Jewish heritage and Jewishness still has enduring value, followers of Jesus who are Jews, they go perfect, we're good with that. They wouldn't have a problem with that. When you get to the point of the ethnic identity Israel and ethnic identity Dios, which is Greek word for Jew, and saying the church has now taken those titles and given them to Gentiles, Jews would go, this is who we are. This is our embodied covenantal identity, and you cannot disembody us and give that identity to a Gentile. So that would be the line drawn. Probably the other element would be salvation, and that's the big question, obviously, is salvation for a Jew who does not follow Yeshua, is that possible? And for Christians, the default is you need to come through Christ, the Christos, to be saved. And so for a Jew outside of Christ, they say that's supersessionist. You're removing our privilege of salvation and giving another prerequisite for it. So that would be a hard stop for somebody outside of Christ who is a Jew. So I think that's the other arena that we have to, just walk through. And that's what the New Perspective dealt with, right? In terms of that Jews in the first century relied upon God's grace for their salvation. They didn't obey Torah to get into covenantal relationship with God, i.e. salvation. They obey Torah to stay in the salvation they already had. And so that new perspective emphasized that aspect, that your salvation is one to lose, not to gain. This is true in terms of covenant faithfulness.
Yeah, and as you may know, on the Jewish side of the discussion, salvation isn't a central topic in the way it is among many Christians. It's all about, what are the requirements for salvation, as opposed to what keeps me in right relationship with God. And a lot of the problem in Jewish Christian discussion is the categories are different. They're coming from a very different perspectives. I tend to be more concerned when I think of the church, is the way that the church takes all the good stuff found in the Old Testament, any good promise, applies it to itself, and leaves all the bad stuff to the Jewish people, and that's not, I'm sure you agree, that's not scriptural. One of my favorites, and I talked about it before, Jeremiah 29:11, the plans I have for you are good, and so on. And people love that verse, put it on a t-shirt, put it on a mug. And I think it's that sentiment carries through to anyone who's in relationship with the God of Israel. But you need to understand it first in its context, which is a letter that Jeremiah wrote to the exiles in Babylon. And so it's not only particular to the Jewish people, it's particular to them in that situation. And then you can begin to expand the implications of a promise like that. And then when you know that God, you know that's part of his character, that he's not out to get us, that he's for our well-being, and so on. But the way promises are immediately applied to the believer, as if that's the original intent of those concepts, that's part of the problem with supersessionism.
And with general Christian interpretation, eisegesis, right? I'll read into it. I'll assume it applies to me automatically without recognizing. No, it had a historical context, a particular scenario and purpose. That's what you have to for sure understand before you can understand, does that apply beyond that particular situation, right? In terms of that promise. Yeah, no, very, very appropriately said.
Whether it was this society for post-supersessionism or post-supersessionist theology or post-supersessionism in general, when did that emerge? Do you know?
The society itself? Or just generally post-supersessionist?
Well, whether it's a society. I don't know what started when and how. Was there already... There must have been, I guess, somebody felt that this needed to be addressed and eventually it got organized. Can you explain that?
I think the impulse, and particularly also the impulse for the new perspective, was the...
You know what, you better, explain new perspective?
So new perspective,
you mentioned it before.
Yeah, new perspective essence was the one I talked about. I mean, the technical term is covenantal nomism, where Jews are already saved because they're in covenantal relationship with the God of Israel, and they obey Torah to maintain that status, not to gain that status. And so that's the basic new perspective, which changes the Protestant Lutheran perspective, where the idea was that Jews did good works to get saved. And E.P. Sanders, in his research on Palestinian Judaism, demonstrated in the 70s that is definitely not the case. When you actually read Jewish literature of that era, there is no talk of gaining salvation through works, righteousness. The talk was God's grace. We are saved by grace. You might say, in ancient Pauline terminology, we are saved by virtue of us being in covenant with the God of Israel. And we obey out of joy and thankfulness as an expression of our gratitude for the grace given us and being in relationship with God. And Torah maintains that relationship for us. So that would be the new perspectives. And in a nutshell.
Are you saying Saunders in the 70s comes before post-supersessionism?
The timeline, I'm not sure technically when the actual terminology or that aspect comes out, but it's really a post-Shoah impulse. So after the Holocaust, then there's a recognition in Christian scholarship that actually our interpretive practices, historically of church, helped create an environment for people to accept persecution of Jews. They're the ones that killed Jesus.
So it took them almost 2,000 years to realize that, and it took the Holocaust.
Yeah, the church has replaced Israel. They're no longer Jews, we're the true Jews. So God is done with the Jews. So that philosophy, that ideology, led to then anti-Judaism, a denigrating Jewish lifestyle, which led to anti-Semitism, which is actions against Jews, harmful actions against Jews. And so post-World War II, there's a recognition, we have to relook at our theology, and the new perspective eventually, is developed out of that through Sanders' work. Post-supersessionism is a little different than the new perspective, in that it's, we're still, it's a very broad community. So anybody who is committed to affirming Jewishness as a lifestyle and the enduring identity, Israel and Jew, only being limited to genealogical Jews, would fall within that post-supersessionist kind of perspective, and would not want to be associated with a supersessionist perspective per se. So I don't have the roots of it technically, but just the philosophical roots, you see them growing out after World War II.
And do you know when the society
I've just formed? Recently joined it, more after I published my book on Reason Revelation after supersessionism. I joined it just the last couple of years, and then they asked if they could do a book review at the Society of Biblical Literature in San Diego last year on it. And so I haven't really dug into the history behind it. I know Kenneth Sulin, who's a systematic theologian, he's a key figure in the post-supersessionist society, because he created theological, philosophical backdrops into which a lot of the exegetical work is being done. Re-looking at the passages in Romans, the so-called Jew Romans 2:17 passage. Not all Israel is Israel, the Romans 9:6, all Israel will be saved, 11:26. Like, all these passages are being reframed through a Jewish lens, you might say, and what do we get when we do that? So a lot of work being done on those specific passages to demonstrate there are alternative ways of viewing them, rather than saying the church is the one who's taken over the identity of Israel and Jew.
Right. So, I find there's two issues that we have, especially reading the Bible in English. There's dealing with possible negative things directed towards Jewish people in the text itself. Then there's how the text is translated that might add an anti-Jewish take to it. I recently did a podcast on my own where something came up with Romans 11:28, which says that in terms of the gospel, they are enemies for your sakes, but they are beloved on account of election, they're beloved for the sake of the forefathers. And you might know that many English translations have added "of God" to enemies. So it says they're enemies of God rather than simply enemies. and leaving it ambiguous. And about a third of English translations clarify the ambiguity and add of God. So there's that. And then there, I've been discovering some other passages too that have concerned me in the translation that there might be anti-Jewish bias on the part of the theologians, whether they're borrowing from people from 100 years ago or from today. Then there's the things like John in, not John, sorry, the term Jews, as it's used in John and in Acts, that can come across to the reader as negative, where it's in, it's already in the text, but is it as negative as people have taken it to be? So you, you guys are working through all that
like
kind
even
of
like
stuff.
The word
right?
Jews, you know, the question is, we read generally, oh, all Jews, all Jewish people are being denigrated by John in the gospel, seen as the enemy of Jesus. But, you know, good scholarship tries to create nuance. And, well, let's take a look at what's actually, who's in view here. And generally, you'll see that it's actually Jewish leadership is being called the Jews. And it's not all of Jewish people being called the Jews in John. And so that narrows the rhetoric and, you know, demonstrates that Gospel of John is not denigrating Jewishness, just the Jewish leaders who were bringing Christ to the cross.
Yeah, and as a, as you're saying, those Jewish leaders who that did that, not all, not even all Jewish leaders. And it's not saying Jewish leaders are like this, but that we get to, we tend to read that back in. Interesting. I'm working personally, I'm working through the book of Acts right now. And Luke also uses Jews in that sort of way that it's similar. It's my understanding, it's different from how John uses it, but similar, at least similar to us. But when Paul gets arrested in Acts 21, when things start to get out of hand, accusing him of bringing a non-Jew into the temple, and the tribune comes and arrests him, and they begin to dialogue a bit. Paul says, "I am a Jew," and that is what the Greek says, and people don't notice that that lingo is being used. Paul himself is applying it to himself. They just, it's somehow there's blinders, and they don't see that. Oh, Paul considered himself a Jew, just like the troublemaking Jewish people, the Jewish disciple types. It, that's how they use the term. But for some reason, it's because, and partly it's because of the history and the demonization of Jewish people through the centuries, that it just, it sticks.
Yeah. Old habits die hard.
Yeah. So do you want to explain Synagogue of Satan to everybody?
Sure. Yeah. So we're dealing here with Revelation. Chapter 2, verse.
Yeah, chapter 2, chapter 3,
nine,
both verse 19,
right? Yeah, exactly.
Nine.
Yeah,
I was close.
Yeah, so there, the basic comment is made that the challenge is against this, those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. So, I mean, historically, at face value, with the English translation as it is made, people simplistically have taken those verses and used them for anti-Judaistic statements and anti-Semitic action, indicating that, look, Revelation, it's inspired scripture. These are the words of, directly from the mouth of Jesus. He is calling Jews that you're not Jews. You say you're Jews, but you are not. He's removing their identity.
And worse, saying they're
even worse, that they actually don't serve the God of Israel, but that they serve Satan. They're a synagogue of Satan. So the synagogue of Satan, again, how we translate, huge implications, because the Greek word for synagogue of Satan is synagoge. And synagoge simply means assembly. So it's a synonym for the Greek word ekklesia, which we translate church. But again, the word church is a very bad English translation of the Greek word ekklesia. Ekklesia just means assembly. on, and by the way, it does not mean called out ones. Anyway.
Right. Especially in the Acts chapter where the rioters in Ephesus are also called ecclesia.
They create an animos ecclesia.
It's a gathering.
It's a civic gathering of the citizens to decide on a particular issue. So basically then, because both mean assembly, interestingly, and because Jews in the first century were the predominant ethnic group that named their gatherings synagogi, typically translators assume, well, when you see the word synagogue, it must be a Jewish institution that's being referenced, and thus we must translate synagogue instead of just assembly at its base meaning. But the problem is that in the first century and prior, the word synagogue was not just a Jewish assembly. It was used by Greco-Roman associations. So associations were affinity groups. So people gather because they had an affinity. They want to create a funerary society or a banqueting society or a religious society or a professional trade guild. Paul's Leathermakers would have been an association. So they're common all throughout the Roman Empire. And there's inscriptional evidence. So inscriptions where people wrote in stone, chiseled in stone, of Greek associations that named themselves synagogue. So there's an association of barbers, and they call themselves a synagogue of barbers. So we know that synagogue as a Greek word does not have to be translated with the automatic Jewish term synagogue. And in my book, I just would recommend that Revelation 2:9 and 3:9 would be translated an assembly of Satan. So there's no ethnic identification. It's a ethnically neutral term then. And so they're an assembly of Satan, which would make sense then. They're following Satan's desires in challenging the Christians, challenging Christ. And ethnicity is not implied there. And when it says, those who say they are Jews and are not, well, that's the question there too, because they say they are Jews and are not. He's not saying you are not Jews. They're saying you say you are Jews and are not. Many scholars, there's 8 different ways to interpret that. I wish I could do it by book. But 2 of them, mine and the approach by Gideon Pagels and by David Frankfurter, we assume that it's Gentiles that are being addressed who are somehow saying they are Jews. So whether they're...
Wannabes, there are so many groups in the world that have done the same thing where, we are we're the Jews. The Jews aren't the Jews, we're the Jews. Or we're also the Jews, but they're Jews. Yeah. They say they're Jews, but they're not. And yet it's still common. You hear it from the front. Jews is the synagogue of Satan. Ran into it recently from a well-known scholar. It's like, you guys got to get busy fixing this thing.
And I mean, again, and Satan, even that translation, automatically we assume it's referring to the devil, the king of the kingdom of darkness over the demonic realm. But, Hasatanos could just be a reference back to the Hasatan of Job, where Hasatan simply means accuser. And so it doesn't necessarily have to refer to the prince of evil, but that they are an assembly of accusers. And why that fits very well with the context. And it doesn't have to necessitate that they're somehow integrally tied to the kingdom of Satan. And so even the translation practice is huge. Like, for example, in James chapter 2, or is it chapter 1, he talks about when somebody comes into your assembly, but the Greek word is synagogue. Yeah. So suddenly in James, we won't translate it synagogue because we don't want Christians to be seen as meeting in synagogues.
And that's the attitude. That's exactly the attitude I'm sure it is. Yeah.
Well, I mean, even the epistle named James, right? It's Yaakov, it's Jacob. It's epistle of Jacob. Yeah. But historically, since the King James Version, it's been Epistle of James. Well, why is that? Removing Jewishness. You see translation practice unwittingly and maybe even intentionally sometimes. Continuing this anti-Judaistic emphasis that can lead to anti-Semitic behavior, which is so unfortunate.
Yes, my impression is that in the post-supersessionist camp, like, and I know they're saying, and you might want to explain why it's post and not anti, but whatever it is, there's a rejection of supersessionism, replacement theology. But there are, like, there's different takes on it, right? Like, there isn't agreement on the place of the Jewish people in God's plan, what's required of the Jewish people, just the general theology of some of these folks that are involved in this are not necessarily the same. There's a lot of diversity. Are you able to explain some of that?
Let me just think where to start. I suddenly drew a blank in my head. I had it all figured on how where to start.
I'm looking over some of the names as I did my own little bit of research. Like, some would be evangelical believers. You know, the Bible's the only authority. There are a need to trust in Jesus Yeshua for, however you put it, salvation, right, relationship with God. Then you might have some more on the liberal side. And you even have some, are there not some Jewish people, non-believing people are not Jesus followers, who are in the society?
That's the beauty of it. It's a really good, wholesome conversation and dialogue among Christians and those who would be Jewish, who don't identify as Christians, and those who would be Gentile, who don't identify as Christians, but who have a real heart.
Messianic Jews involved as well,
mix.
Right?
It's actually a good example of scholarship as community, not as competition. And so there's that repartee back and forth, refining, honing, that takes place, but it's all in with a real intent and purpose to maintain the value of Jewishness and the Jewish people and God's salvific economy going forward.
Some people on the Christian side have in their minds and hearts have resolved the supersessionist issue by saying Jewish people are okay just with Moses and they don't need Yeshua the Messiah. While others would lean more towards a traditional, Yeshua said, I'm the only, I'm the way, the truth, and life. No one comes to the Father but through me. That, I know you're going to deal with that in your book. I don't know how easy that is to deal, But that would be a major difference. One of the Christian reactions to the Holocaust has been to just value the Jewish people as we are with our historical covenant, and then we don't need the new covenant at all.
That'd be like the two covenant approach, John Gager, or just leave the Jews alone. They're good. They're already saved. And we can invite Jews into salvation Messiah for a whole nother level of understanding and experience, but gospel's for the Gentiles primarily. Most new perspective people would not agree. So Dunn would not agree with that. Wright would not agree with that. They would say that Christ is a fulfillment and that there is the fullness of salvation only available through Christ for Jews who are not following Christ at this particular point in time. There's that. And I would say, and actually, it's an essay that I'm just going to be getting published this next year in an edited volume from the Pacific Northwest Scholars. We put together a book project on authority and power in early Christian world, power and authority in the early Christian world. And there I deal with a lot of the passages in Romans. And I think the conversation needs to go prior to Moses in terms of God's sort of salvific process with the Jews to the Abraham. And that for Abraham, it's not just genealogical descent that determines why he was credited with righteousness, but it was this faith that resulted in faithfulness. And so there's a faithfulness component, which pre-Mosaic is not Torah. What is it? We don't have specifics necessarily. But there's the faith component, a full heart trust, yielding one's life completely to Yahweh's, sorry, I shouldn't use the word Hashem's, a will and purpose. And so within Abraham's lineage, physically, there's a spiritual lineage that mirrors his faith. And so what I suggest is there's a category, holistic Jew, ever since Abraham's day, which is somebody who's born out of the lineage of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but who also then has the faith of Abraham, a complete heart trust in the sovereign God, and that is what determines salvation. And it's been the remnant of Israel's stream right throughout all of human history. And so the question is then, did that stream end suddenly at the cross, or does it continue parallel with the cross, parallel with Yeshua, such that, and here's where we get into the realized eschatology at future eschatology piece, that for Jews who have an Abrahamic faith, but not yet fulfilled in Yeshua as the eschatological promised son of Abraham that Paul talks about in Galatians 2, that their salvation they will not experience until they wake up on the other side in heaven and recognize that, Yeshua, you've been the fulfillment of this faith we had, and we either rejected you because we didn't like how Christians presented you, or we weren't aware of you, or out of ignorance, but that basically they have forensic salvation, as Abraham did. You know, their faith is credited as righteousness before God, but they won't experience that salvation during their lifetime until they commit to Yeshua as the promise. That's the realized part. And only those who commit their life fully to the sovereign God through faith in Yeshua as God the Son can experience their future salvation now in this life. That's what John's gospel is doing. He's only talking about generally salvation in this life, experiencing it, not in the future like the other gospels do. And so what I explore is, can we see that big basic perspective? So, you know, imagine Paul's Tree of Israel metaphor. You have the Tree of Israel, the physical part, you know, the embodied part, but inside you've got the living sap. And so a holistic Jew is somebody who is embodied in the lineage of Abraham, but has his living faith inside. And that in the Messianic age, when Paul talks about the branches, that a Jew who has Abrahamic faith, but hasn't placed their faith in Yeshua as a fulfillment of the Abrahamic faith, would be like a dormant branch. They have sap in them, but they're not producing fruit in this life yet. And it'd only be at the end that they, when they're in the presence of God, that they now realize that salvation in an embodied state. And that Jesus' exclusivity is for experiencing our future salvation in this life now. And so just to go back to John 14:6, I wonder whether what Jesus says there, no one comes to the Father except through me, he's talking about in this life. No one comes into an intimate walk with God as Father during their lifetime except through exclusive commitment to me as the Son of God. Because I've seen God, I've shared him with you. Whoever's seen me has seen the Father. So I'm the only way you're going to experience life in this life. But there would be an Abrahamic faith stream without Yeshua that would only experience life in the next life, not in this life. So that's some of the distinctions I'm trying to work with And in my book on Revelation, I bring that perspective, and I suggest that the 144,000 are genealogical Jews who have the faith of Abraham, but who have not yet fulfilled that faith in committing to Christ.
No, we only need this kind of category because, I don't know how crass this might sound, but the church really blew it vis-a-vis the Jewish people. The Gentilization of Jesus is terrible. The fact that that early group of Jewish believers went out of their way to allow Gentiles to come in, I think is a miracle in and of itself, that a people group that would feel alienated from the world, that had been told to be kept separate by God himself, somehow found a way to bring the goodness of God to the nations is almost beyond belief. It's astounding. And then how does that get repaid? By demonizing the very people group that risked their lives to bring Messiah and the true God to them. And so I know there's various thoughts of how do you reckon with this very bad public relations thing from the church to the Jewish people? But it is so, so heartbreaking to me. As a good friend of mine, a minister friend of mine years ago said, if he said, Jesus, I like Yeshua, but he said, if Jesus isn't the Messiah of the Jews, he's no one's Messiah. And somehow we need to restore that the King of the Jews is the Savior of the world. And I was sharing with a fairly new Jewish believer the other day how thoroughly Jewish the New Testament really is. And as you know, it's almost incoherent to the non-Jewish world, but it's just become so taken for granted as this quote-unquote Christian book, they don't even know how Jewish it is. And then to the point that they'll miss that Paul says, I am a Jew. And then later on, I love this one. You could use it as a party, a party game. But that when Paul is before the Sanhedrin, that scene where he sees some are Pharisees and some are Sadducees, and he wants to talk about the resurrection of the dead and causes a kerfuffle, he introduces himself. He says, I am a Pharisee and a son of Pharisees. He doesn't say I was. So the great apostle Paul is actually affirming that he is still a Pharisee. So much of, instead of teaching kids, I don't want to be a Pharisee. Like it's a complete misrepresentation of the essential Jewishness of the whole Bible and the New Testament in particular. So, thank God for people like yourself who are trying to rework all this. So my understanding is some of the people in the society, or people who at least would consider themselves as post-supersessionist, they would actually see elements of the New Testament as anti-Jewish. While others would go, no, you're misunderstanding those passages. It's not anti-Jewish. Am I right?
Within that society, some would view passages as being anti-Jewish.
Yeah, so I know I've looked some things up in the Jewish annotated New Testament, for example, and it'll point or say, so they would see that this statement by Paul or this way of referring to Jews over here, they would just see it as truly anti-Jewish. Well, and I admit, maybe I'm going a little, I'm biased. I admit my bias. I am looking to disprove that everywhere. Every time I find something that is, as theologians would say, too ouchy towards Jewish people, that perhaps it's the translation, perhaps it's the history. The Bible is critical towards everybody. The Hebrew Bible is very critical towards Israel. But that doesn't seem to bother people as much. And the people that are acting badly are called out for doing that. Judas, it would be better for him not to be born. That's not very positive. But there is so much that's normally taken as negative that I don't think is negative at all. And it's been misrepresented.
Yeah, no, a totally fair point. And you're right. So there would be those who would find it very difficult not to read John's "the Jews" as referring to an anti-Judaistic statement in general. And so that gets worked through in the society, very much so. Yeah. I mean, the one thing that I suggest in terms of the supersessionist piece is that the church does not replace Israel, but Jews and Gentiles in Christ are further emplaced within Israel. So there's a further emplacement within the covenantal commitment of Israel, particularly for Gentiles. They don't become Israel, they don't become Jews, but they're emplaced into a Jewish heritage, covenantal benefits thereof. And if you want to use the word ecclesia, you might say that they don't become part of the people of God, i.e. Israel. They become part of the ecclesia of Israel. And like when you see the people of Israel in the desert wanderings, they're called in a Septuagint, the ecclesia of the Lord. And that's a national title. Yeah, and the ecclesia of the Lord was a mixed multitude. There were Gentiles as part of the ecclesia as they met as the people of the Lord that went traveled in the desert. And so I think for Paul, the ecclesia term was a beautiful way to affirm the Gentile mission that's rooted in an eternal Jewish heritage. And that's one way to view the value of the Greek word ecclesia that he named his communities, aside from the Greek.
What about the concept in Ephesians in English translations? It tends to be the Commonwealth of Israel. And as Canadians, we're supposed to know what a Commonwealth is like, to the point that now it's the king. When the king comes to Canada, he's not the king of England, he's the king of Canada. And so we have this connection to Britain without being actually British. Do you think it's similar? Do you think the terminology in the New Testament is that way, that the nations become part of a commonwealth of Israel? So Israel's the hub without
that's actually a good way to look at it. I hadn't thought about that. I'll have to think about that more, but I think that's a helpful analogy. Yeah. So that the identity is Israel, but there's not common wheel or commonwealth that other nations can become a part of without replacing Israel as that central.
Right. So then Jerusalem becomes a double-pronged capital. It's the capital of Israel, the physical nation, Israel, country, while being a capital of the broader people of God. And so there's a both and going on. It's a complex unity.
Yeah. I think you see that in Revelation. See, I'm just going to close it here. The book of Revelation was in the Jerusalem image. So the new Jerusalem has 12 gates, and written above the 12 gates are the 12 names of the tribes of Israel. And it has 12-fold foundation, which are identified as the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And so really the 12 foundations is a technical term, synecdoche, or this image represents something much bigger. And so for the 12 apostles of the Lamb, well, that's what we call the church, Gentile and Jewish believers in Yeshua. Well, then what's the 12 gates? Is it a redundant repetition of the foundation? But it says it's a 12 tribes of Israel. So it's a very Jewish identity, indicating you've got both in continuity eternally.
Though, Ralph, I did a very careful analysis of those names, and I discovered that they're all Jewish.
Which names?
All the names. The apostles and the tribes.
Yeah.
People seem to forget that the whole enterprise is a Jewish enterprise. Oh, no, That's what people think Jews are always doing. They're just taking over everything all the time.
Yeah. Well, and again, it brings up the fact that there was no Christianity in the first century. So followers of Jesus weren't Christians in the sense of a separate religion, right? They didn't leave Judaism. They were another sect within Judaism, just like Pharisees, Sadducees, Zealots, Essenes. Now you had Messianics or Yeshuaites or however they would perhaps refer to. And so they weren't in any way leaving their Jewish heritage. They were just saying, we're giving you more fullness of what it means to be a Jew because Messiah has come and Yeshua is Messiah and their life and that abundantly.
Yeah. One of the things I want to look into is how some of the early antagonism, whether it was the Roman society towards the new Messianic movement or non-Jews in the new Messianic movement, how much of it was actually like a political tension between, because the Jewish people had special status in the first century, and then issues about non-Jews associating themselves with synagogues. Yes. Now we've got and this is the kicker here, non-Jews are now claiming to be part of this Jewish thing and they're not circumcised. And the mess on the societal, political side that might have caused all sorts of tension on the parts of several parties. And I'm wondering if that's where maybe some of the resentment and struggle was coming from, because these were very actually serious. The Jewish exemption that the Jewish community had in the Roman Empire was really worth something. And then you had Gentiles who were drawn to that. They didn't want to do the pagan things, but they didn't want to be circumcised. And so now we have, it's more than just a faith and nice community thing going on. There's some real serious ramifications to all that might have caused trouble. But I don't have that all worked out.
Scholars have well investigated that angle, that there are social and political implications of Messianics identifying as Jews, i.e. Gentile identifying with Jews and gaining the benefits. And the Jews going, oh my goodness, so the Romans find out that we're hiding Gentiles and giving extra tax benefits. We're going to lose our status. We can't have this. There's more theological problems arise from money than theology.
Yeah. Now again, okay. So Jews and money, but what the non-Jewish world often fails to see is how God chose the Jewish people to be like the litmus test, the prototype of almost everything. Sometimes when people critique anti-Semitism, they'll say that if you want to understand the anti-Semites, see the thing that they are hating the Jews about, and often it's actually a reflection of themselves. And it's just the Jewish people function in this way. So instead of what should happen, the lessons that the non-Jewish world should be gaining from their observation of Jewish people is that they're a mirror of everybody else. And the Jewish people function in that way as an example for the world to see. And so instead of condemning the Jewish people for acting a particular way, the world should be learning lessons of life by seeing how things are working out with Jewish people. And so God chose the Jew, you know, what the choosing of the Jews, even in that situation, showing the world what happens when you are chosen by God and set apart by God, and then, in a sense, all hell breaks loose, and we should be learning valuable lessons from all that. Well, I do appreciate the time that you've been spending. I want to ask you one more thing. I'm not sure how you're going to respond to it. It's theological. It's biblical. Yeah. I just want to get your opinion on Galatians 6:16.
Aha!
The Israel of God. Who are they?
Well, there's a few different perspectives on that,
Right. So, and you could books have been probably written.
It all comes down to the second and in the sentence. Okay. And the Israel of God, or even the Israel of God, also the Israel of God. So basically, you could say that the Israel God is now the church. And that very clearly in Galatians 6, Paul's saying the Israel of God is the church, even the Israel of God. So he's talking about followers of Christ and says they're also the Israel of God. That doesn't have to be the way to interpret that. The other way to interpret it that I do where do I do that? Can't remember. Anyway, on my Ecclesia book, is that this Israel of God is the same people that Paul references in chapter 1, verse 10, the Judaizers who are from James, basically, and that they are the Israel of God he's referencing. So he lambastes them at the beginning for mandating Gentiles to be circumcised and to become Jewish as a prerequisite for following Messiah. But he then amends his bridges, so to speak, at the end, by still affirming that he's praying a blessing upon the Israel of God, i.e. Jews who are followers and somehow connected with James, but who mandate circumcision of Gentiles. He's not totally disenfranchising them from his circle of relationship. He's bending bridges a bit and saying, I still also bless the Israel of God. And so he's not go ahead.
Yeah. Is he, just to clarify, when you talk about the people connected with James, often right. also called the Judaizers, are you saying therefore they are Jewish people connected in some way to Yeshua, but also believe in the need for circumcision? Or is it all Jewish people?
Just followers of Yeshua who are Jewish, who now mandate that Gentiles must become Jewish as followers of Messiah by being circumcised.
But wouldn't the Jewish believers who don't believe, Jewish believers like Paul, who didn't think that circumcision was still compulsory for Gentiles, wouldn't they be included in the Israel of God?
Yes. So he's not saying only James's followers are the Israel of God. He's just saying, as Jews, we're all the Israel of God. But in it's chapter 6, he's blessing the Ecclesia, which follows his way of engaging the Gentiles and allowing them to maintain their social identity in Christ. They don't have to change their social identity to become Jewish. And so he's blessing the Ecclesia, Jews and Gentiles who are, you know, recognizing Gentiles don't have to be circumcised and they're all followers of Christ. But he recognizes there is a segment of the followers of Christ who are associated with James, who are Jews, but yet who say Gentiles have to be circumcised. So by also adding a blessing to the Israel of God, he has a general blessing to all the Ecclesia members, Jews and Gentiles, who don't mandate circumcision. And he accommodates the fact that James's followers are followers of Jesus and their brothers in Christ. And so he provides a blessing for them by focusing upon their essential identity as the Israel of God. He can't approve them for what they're doing, but he can approve them for who they are as a Jew. And so he's saying, I still affirm the value of who you are as a Jew and as a follower of Jesus, but I can't affirm what you're teaching about how Gentiles need to live as followers of Messiah.
Especially in a book where he refers to their private parts at some point, and isn't very nice about it. But it does sound like you're saying, therefore, in order to bless them, he's blessing them because he makes a general statement about Israel, because he's yep. part of the Israel of God, yep. right? The way that he's part of the Israel of God and these guys are part of the Israel of God is because the Israel of
right.
God are
yeah,
Jewish.
It's not the church,
no?
But he says Israel of God.
Right.
But it's all,
So as you probably know, there are people that base their supersessionism
oh, yeah.
on that
that's
verse.
Probably the strongest evidence that they would garner for that.
Right. Yeah. And I would love, maybe I've been encouraged to write a book on this because it's I think there's a lot of confusion. And there's a retired pastor here in town that I was in touch with, and he grew up with a very strong, understanding Israel and God's plan kind of position. And then he thinks he got enlightened. And then the kicker for him was Galatians 6:16 to prove that the church is Israel. And so I've done a bit of research and talking to Greek experts. And one of the interesting things is the grammar itself people don't realize the verse doesn't really tell us. But it became clear to me that Israel of God is Israel of God. There is no other Israel but the what we now call the Jewish people. And so he's saying a blessing upon them, which would make sense. So there's a scholar from a theological school on the West Coast that I had some back and forth with this on it. And in an email, he told me, first of all, in his opinion, Israel always means Israel in the New Testament. It's the literal Israel, what we now call the Jewish people. So then this would have to be an exception. I also know that the grammar itself doesn't tell us what it is. And yet he still leaned towards it's the church. So I wrote him back and I said something to the extent of, would I be crazy to think that after Paul was talking so strongly against these called Judaizers about circumcision and all the rest, and on and on and on and on, so negatively that when he gets to the end and he says, blessing upon all those who hold to this rule and the Israel of God, it could have been his way of saying, but don't forget the Jewish people. I'm not getting negative on my people, blessing upon my people. And would I be crazy to think that? And he said, no, I wouldn't be crazy. He's not a psychologist, but I appreciate his sentiment.
I think you're on the right trajectory there. Yeah. Paul's not identifying Israel's God with the church. He's identifying as the people who are Jewish.
Okay.
And he's just identifying there are Jewish people following Jesus who I'm blessing because they're following my rule of the ecclesia. And there are Jewish people who follow Jesus who are not following my rule, but they still deserve a blessing because they're the Israel of God. And so I'll bless them. Even though I lambasted them at the beginning of my letter.
Yeah. And he's lambasting believers who have a particular approach, as opposed to, he's not lambasting Jewish people.
Just believers.
Anyway, but you can see, and I don't know I would love to know what Paul was picking up in Romans 11 when he began to confront the growing arrogance. Like, where was it coming from? What did it look like? Because that we don't have. But you could see how his teaching on circumcision unto Gentiles, well, we know in Acts, the rumor was that he was teaching that Jews shouldn't circumcise their own children, which he never taught at all. And he never undermined the Torah. He never undermined Moses for Jewish people. Anyway, there's so much more we could talk about. I really appreciate your time. If people want to contact you, what's the best way to do that?
Could probably just email me. If they would so choose, may take a while for me to get back to them. Things are very busy. But my email, is, ralph.corner, KORNER at taylor-edu.ca. So Taylor as in my shirt, taylor.edu. -edu.ca.
Very good. And I'll make sure that's in the description so people can reference that. Well, Ralph, thank you so much for taking the time to do this and for joining me on some of my bunny trails that I took you. I hope it was all around helpful to the conversation, and looking forward to next time.
Yeah, so my blessing.
Thank you so much. Well, what'd you think of that? Let me know by commenting below or by emailing me at comments@thinkingbiblically.org. If you found it helpful, remember again to give it a thumbs up. Be sure to subscribe and to share as well. If you want to contact Dr. Korner, you can email him at ralph.korner@taylor-edu.ca. You can check out the Society for Post-Supersessionist Theology at www.spost.org. It's a good thing I put these links in the description. Past episodes of Thinking Biblically are available at thinkingbiblically.org. And while there, please consider supporting my Bible teaching ministry. Your donations are greatly appreciated. And as I said, all the links will be in the description. And so, until next time, this is Alan Gilman with Thinking Biblically.